It will call to order the January meeting of the Curie Beach Planning and Zoning Commission. The first item is the adoption of the agenda. I would like to add one item for old business, and that is a discussion of prohibited uses. I think we talked about that last time. So as number five, a discussion of prohibited uses in our zoning regulations.
Move to adopt as amended.
Okay, is there second. Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Next item is the approval of the December 4th meeting minutes. Just take a minute and look at the minutes and see if there's any changes you would recommend. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Is there a second? Okay. It's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion, or do you need a couple more minutes to look at it? No. Nope. Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Okay. Passes. Public comments. Any public comments? Okay. Hearing none, move on to old business. Presentation by the intern. We can start taking that off. The interns are finished with their internship now, so we won't be hearing from interns. Graffiti ordinance. This is one that actually I presented. I gave kind of a model example several months ago, I think it was, and we keep kind of passing on this. It's not really a pressing issue, so we can. I recommend tabling this item and kind of just hanging it out there and. One of these days, I'll bring a proposed ordinance before the PNZ to look at. But I mean, we don't have any problems in Curie Beach right now, so it's not something that is super, super pressing. But I think it's something that we should deal with.
I think we should keep it alive, even if tabled.
Yes,
because
I agree.
As discussed several months ago, when it becomes a problem overnight.
Right, right, right. So I do have a model ordinance. I think I actually presented it probably about 6 months ago. If I could tweak that a little bit, I'll bring that back to the PNC, maybe for our next meeting.
Move to table.
Okay, is there a second?
Second.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Next item is legislative update and recommendations.
Thank you. I'm going to start off by telling you what my approach has been and what I'm running into, and then we can get to the document that was handed out. And John, I'm going to need your input on some of these things because I'll need some direction from John and the commission on how to move forward on some of these things. I've been a local government attorney for 20 years, and legislative updates are part and parcel of what I do. And this is one of the more, and this is not even getting to the new chapter 160D, which rewrites everything. This presentation tonight only concerns those amendments which are currently effective. Remember, they've recodified all the county and city land development statutes into a new chapter, which won't be effective until next January, and we're all going to a training session on that next week. These are the current ones. They fall into three or four groups: zoning and land development, subdivision, building and inspections, and what I call quasi-judicial, which doesn't concern you all so much until we know what HPC's status is. What I'm bringing for you tonight is zoning and land development and subdivision regulations, but I also wanted to mention here in the beginning that I'll cover the changes to the quasi-judicial statutes in a memorandum to the Board of Adjustment for some training that is scheduled later this month, January 28th. I'm also going to prepare, just although John's probably already on top of it, a very simple memo for building and inspections regarding the current changes so that John's got that information if he needs it. There may be some text amendments that come out of that. It doesn't look like it at present, and it doesn't look like it for quasi-judicial either.
So with those things in mind, let's turn to what I do think requires some text amendments into the code. So we're going to start planning and zone development. I'm just going to walk down the list. Third-party down zoning. The General Assembly amended the statute to prohibit third-party down zoning without the owner's written consent. However, the town can down zone without owner's consent, and an owner can petition for down zoning. I do think we need to plug those provisions into the code just to make it clear. Also, the amended statute 168.384A also allows for third-party applications for rezoning, and when we did our last text amendment, we didn't provide for that. So for those two reasons, the prohibitions and the other regulations regarding a petition for down zoning and third-party petitioning for the same, I do think we need to amend the code for that.
Just for clarification, we amended the code probably about 3 months ago that would not allow third-party petitions to downzone other people's property.
Or
to change zoning to petition zoning.
We approached that problem by limiting the authority to submit an application to town boards, owners, respective vendees, and agents. Mm-hmm. In other words, we solved that problem by carving out a third party being able to submit an application. Under the amended statute, it clearly references, obviously you have third parties if the owner's consent is required. So I want to go back into that provision that we text amendment to allow for a third party, but also to plug in the clear changes that the session laws require.
Can that be carefully worded to qualified third parties so that you're not disallowing third parties, but you're not allowing somebody random to make a...
No, I don't think we can make that distinction. I think a third party is a third party.
Okay.
So
but when we did it, as Chairman referenced, we did spend some time with that previous amendment what constitutes an applicant, particularly with respect to an organized entity. So I'm pretty comfortable that the controls are there, but I don't think we can say this third party can, but that third party can't.
Okay. So you'll have something, I mean, do you need a motion from us to give you guidance to come up with language that for our next meeting?
I'm just going to address that at the end. If I've got two memorandums to do, I'm not sure that I can get to the text amendments by February.
Okay.
We might get to them. We might. Let me put it to you this way. Let me go to the end now.
Before you do that, one quick question. If these are, from what I understand, these are actions as of now. I mean, when we talk about legislative requirements as of January 1st, 2020. That's what we're talking about right now.
What you've got in front of you are already effective.
Are already effective. So what is the danger of us not addressing these quick and holding off until April or May when, in fact, they're effective right now?
You can approach that one of two ways. We can giddy up the text amendments and put the memorandums on the back burner. It's also, I think, sufficient that if an issue arises before the text amendments are in place, and with this information in front of staff, an issue can be caught, and the statute, we'd have to analyze the situation, but the statute may control. We just have, if an issue comes up that's related to one of these text amendments, which are already effective before code is conformed, then we'll analyze that situation based on the circumstances and take the right course. But this information allows us to see that issue as it comes. I'm not aware of any land development applications at the present time.
Okay.
So what might help us move forward is whether each one of these, I'll end up discussing each one of these things with a recommendation as to whether we need a text amendments, and two of the bigger ones, I definitely need instructions from John, and with John's input from the commission on whether to do text amendments. So as we finish discussing each one,
somebody needs a move, right?
What's that, Nerdy Paul? let's do this. With this first item that we discussed, do you agree that a text amendment would be helpful for staff and the public?
Yes, okay. Yeah, I think so.
So that one's good. The second one doesn't concern you all so much, but it is a recommended text amendment to Chapter 15, which is the new zoning chapter. When council decides special use permits in their quasi-judicial hearing, the controlling statute allows them to impose certain conditions if they deem them necessary and if they're reasonable. What the General Assembly did with this in the last session was to amend that statute to provide a clear listing of items which are prohibited as conditions. For example, the statute now requires the council not to impose conditions imposing additional taxes, impact fees, building design elements. You'll recall that's prohibited for one and two family dwellings, but not for commercial and multifamily. And driveway related improvements exceeding the controlling statute -307. It's my recommendation, since the code currently references conditions for special use permits in a generalized fashion, that in order to prevent risk management, so to speak, that we go ahead and text amend that particular provision in the code and include this listing of what is prohibited as a condition. John, jump in for any of these. Do you have any comment on that?
Yes, sir.
From what I understand when I read this is that you still, in a special use permit, you still can have design elements for commercial and multifamily housing.
That's correct.
Okay. So that's the primary concern, I think, is design elements for commercial buildings, you know, lighting and those sort of things that might be part of a special use permit. Again, we saw that with the rental property or the golf cart rental sort of thing. But so this prohibits, which I thought we already had.
There is a stat that, if I can jump in.
Yeah, because I thought that was prohibited already when it came to residential.
There is a statute that prohibits requiring design elements for single and duplex family
housing.
That's not what this, what I'm recommending here is, got that element in it, but it's a different, it's a different idea. You got a statute that says you can't regulate design elements on one and two family housing. This particular legislative enactment says when you're imposing conditions on special use permits, here are the six or seven things that you cannot do. It just so happens that the prohibition against design elements for one and two family housing was pulled into this legislative enactment as well. It just references. But my recommendation to the commission is that we text amend that part of the code and put this listing in the special use provisions of what is not allowed as a condition. It just so happens that one of the conditions that are not allowed are design elements for one and two family housing.
Okay.
But this is about special use provisions.
Right. If a developer comes in, again, then we may not have this problem, although we did have one case just fairly recently. A developer comes in, and typically a special use permit would be for a development, not for a single unit housing. So you'd have a developer come in and require or ask for a special use permit, let's say for a 20 unit, not 20 unit, but 20 maybe single family units. This would, so it's not a special use permit for each one of the units, but for the whole development. And one of the things that we were looking at in terms of the special use permit is, in fact, driveway issues and drainage issues and some of these type of things. Would this now prohibit asking them to adjust driveways and the sort of things that we did before for a special use permit for a whole development, not one unit, but for a whole development.
If I come in for a special use permit and it's granted by council, they have the ability to put conditions on my special use permit. My special use permit in that instance, using your hypothetical, would be with respect to the entire development, not per unit in that development. Point one. Point two, the authority of council to impose reasonable and necessary conditions on a special use permit survives unlimited. That's interesting. If you tell me what to do, I'll be glad to do it. What the General Assembly has done is carve out six or seven instances of what you cannot impose as a condition. With respect to your comment about driveways, if you look at this table, one of the things that the General Assembly says that you cannot do as a condition are driveway-related improvements in excess of that statute. I haven't looked at that statute yet. You can still make driveway improvements as long as the condition is within the scope of what is allowed in 168-307. You can't exceed that scope.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is the consensus with John's input to include in the applicable special use provision in the code this listing of what is not allowed as conditions which council has the authority to impose? I think that would be beneficial for staff, council, and the public.
Well, that's fine with me.
Yeah.
Now, again, you're going to have a number of different text amendments here. I think from the council's perspective, it's important that we don't piecemeal this, that, you know, that they're given all at one time, so they're going to have one public hearing and all that sort of thing.
That's correct, and that was one of the considerations I had when I was trying to put together a timetable for drafting those text amendments, that it would not be.
Okay.
The third one, I don't believe, requires a text amendment because I didn't find anything in the code pertaining to it. And John can correct me if I've missed something, but they've done a small house amendment which basically prohibits zoning regulations from including a minimum square footage requirement one two-family residential dwellings. In other words, you can't regulate by zoning and say a one-family or two-family has to have at least this much square footage. And I didn't see anything in the code that has that requirement.
There is usability code.
So we're okay in that regard. And of course, that makes you think of shipping containers. But if you will recall, the used as dwelling units, but if you will recall our approach there was to prohibit containers as dwelling units. It doesn't get into minimum square footage. So we don't lose anything, and because we don't require minimum square footage for those dwellings, there's nothing to amend in the code. Just wanted to bring that to your attention. Any questions on that one? Now, the next two are complicated. It's easy to state what the legislative amendments consist of, but it's the application of those amendments which starts to get real interesting. These are also two areas which interact with each other and can create some complexity. And these are two areas that are not referenced at all in the code. Permit choice rule and vested rights. There's nothing in Chapter 15 about either. And one of the things that I'm going to be asking, again with John's input, the Commission for instructions on is whether we should text amend the code to cover these things. So keep that in mind as we walk through this. Permit choice, it's an easy enough rule and it's been around for a while. If a application for a development permit is submitted, if the rules regarding that development permit change before the permit is issued, then the applicant may choose whether the application is reviewed under the old or new rules. Now let me keep that in mind for a minute and go to the next one, vested rights. this session law also amended the vested rights statute, which again has been around for years, to broaden and clarify types of statutory vested rights. The duration periods for such rights are also clarified. For example, it's 2 years now, so long as development is ongoing. It's 7 years for multifamily housing or multifamily development. But here's where it gets real interesting. Let me read you something from the School of Government bulletin. This shows the interplay between the permit choice rule and vested rights, and also shows you how it can get complicated for staff to apply and for the public to understand. For example, if an applicant submitted an application for subdivision plat approval, which could be phased development, the permit choice rule would protect that applicant from changes to other development regulations which would apply to other development permits, such as zoning permits, like compliance, site plan and building permits. All the rules in other development regulations applicable at the time of the application for plat approval is submitted may, at the election of the applicant, be applied to the decision for approvals under those other regulations. So in other words, if I come in for a five-phase subdivision in 2019, and I get subdivision approval, and sometimes subsequent to that, they change either the ordinance or the statutes, change the regulations regarding zoning compliance, which development would require after subdivision plan approval. Somebody's going to come in and say, I want to do these units, you're going to make sure they comply, is that correct? And then also, you're going to get a building permit. If the rules for the zoning compliance and the building permits change subsequent to my original subdivision plan approval in 2019, I get to decide, the developer gets to decide, which of those new rules, whether I go in under the old building permit rules or the new building permit. So it can get pretty squirrely, given the fact that the permit choice rule dates back to the initial development approval and affects what rules are utilized for the other development permits that that initial approval has to get over time while the property is being developed. You understand that? Mm-hmm.
Can the developer change his mind in phase?
That's a good question. Well, not in phases, but with respect to whatever development permit is next in line. Yes, he can elect to pick old or new in that case.
Each time, for each phase?
Not each phase, each development permit requirement. If I get my subdivision plat approval, I'm going to come in eventually later for a zoning compliance permit, and I'm going to come in after that for a building permit. If assumed for the sake of discussion that the compliance permit rules and the building permit rules changed subsequent to my plat approval, then each one of those permit applications I can choose to go under the old or new, not the phases of development, the permit applications that I have to get down line. Now, the problem with respect to, let me get one thing. With respect to vested rights, the statute was amended, and again, that statute's been around for a long time. The statute was amended to provide a clear listing of the vested rights you secure under the statute. You've also got common law vested rights, but we're not concerned about that for this discussion. The statute was amended to provide vested rights for subdivisions of land that's always been around, a vested right under a development agreement. In other words, if I enter into a development agreement, a 20-year development agreement for Project X with the town, and as long as I continue to be active under that development agreement, I'm vested. You can change the zoning ordinance, but it doesn't affect me because I'm vested. But the interesting one is you can now pick up a statutory vested right. And I'm not quite sure what this means for buildings or uses of buildings or uses of land for which a development permit application has been submitted. So now it's clear that if I get a plat approval, I'm vested. If I have a development agreement, I'm vested. If I have a site-specific plan that's been approved, I'm vested. But this change also allows statutory vested rights on how I use a building or the building itself. I'm not quite sure what that means, but it's a new addition and it's something that needs to be looked at. But my real question to you all is this. This discussion indicates that the permit choice rule, in conjunction with the vested rights provisions for statutory vested rights, can create some interesting scenarios like we just walked through regarding that multi-phase development and which rules I'm going to elect down line when each time I have a development permit application. There's nothing in the code that I saw that addresses vested rights, and there's nothing in the code that I saw that addresses permit choice rules. And there's two schools of thought, and I'm 50-50 either way. If we text amend the code, we're not going to copy and paste the statute, but we certainly would paraphrase the statute. We're going to incorporate, if we text amend the code to reflect these changes, we're going to carry the substance of those statutes into these changes. So in that sense, it's redundant. One school of thought would say, we don't need it in the code because it's controlled by statute. On the other hand, if you paraphrase these changes and put some text amendments in the code to address permit choice rules, how they work based on the examples that we talked about, and vested rights and their duration and how they work and what generates them, I tend to think that may be useful for, and I want John to weigh in on this as well, that may be useful for staff and it may be useful for the public. So my question to you is, and with John's input, is do we want to text amend the code to cover these two topics, or do we want to leave them out of the code with the assumption that staff and the public and the developer would know where to go to find, to navigate these issues?
If I can ask one question about vested rights, that's a different issue than the grandfathering clause because, you know, let's say we'll be talking about lights later. Let's say that we pass an ordinance that lighting has to be a certain thing, and there's somebody that has a bright light right now. It's my understanding that as long as the amortization process is reasonable, that you can have non-complying characteristics amortize, give people a reasonable time to correct it up to the current code. That is a different issue than what you're talking about in terms of a vested right here, just to make sure that we're talking about two separate things.
That is correct. Vested rights arise out of approved development permits. They have nothing to do with non-conforming situations.
Okay, all right. Okay.
If I come in, and to boil it down, if I come in with, if I enter into a development agreement or I get subdivision plat approval or I bring a site-specific plan, which is defined in the statute as among various things, and that's approved. If my development project is approved, then for 2 years, I'm not subject to any changes that you make in the ordinance which affect my approved development project. I'm good. I can still do what my approved permit allows me to do regardless of any changes you may make. For example, I may come in with a subdivision plat that grants me, that you all approve that grants me X density. You may go on the next year and reduce that density requirement. I'm still allowed, under my vested rights, to use the density that was approved, not the new requirement. So that's how vested rights works in a nutshell.
Okay.
You're protected against legislative changes, but they all arise out of an approved development project or an approved development permit. Let me say one other thing. Permit choice, the legislative changes to the permit choice rule statute, and the legislative changes to the vested rights statutes, and there's another instance that I can't recall, they all, these statutes, let me start over again. Permit choice rule statute is 143-755. When you get into the vested rights statute, there are several, and there's another statute I just simply can't recall right now, that specifically incorporated by reference 143-755. And 143-755 was amended to, revised to amend the definitions for development permit, and land development regulations. So whether we specifically address permit choice rule and vested rights, we do need to at least amend the code to conform, because that in Chapter 15, we need to insert those definitions. In Chapter, what's 11, is that? In Chapter 11, there's a development definition that needs to be revised in accordance with the new definition as well. That's just FYI. So we've got to amend the code for the definitions. My question is, do you want to amend the code to specifically address vested rights and the permit choice rule based on this discussion, on the assumption that it would be helpful for staff and beneficial for the public, or do we want to remain silent? Do we want the code to remain silent on those as it currently is, with the understanding that they're covered by statute, and staff and a developer would know to go to those statutes? And you, my thinking is you should ask John which way to go.
Yeah.
I can't think of another situation where we're going to run into that, since we're pretty much developed out. That's kind of rather see spelled out in our ordinances and have somebody rely on going to the general statutes for their guidance. One wouldn't be a surprise.
So your opinion is to just leave it the way it is, stay silent, and if something were to come up, even though it doesn't look like it's going to come up, then...
Put it in the code.
Okay.
Yeah, put it in the code.
He doesn't want it to be a surprise.
So it's clear.
In simple clarity. So if it needs, it should be there, then...
So that's the consensus of the commission?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The last one under zoning is land development definitions. I just got finished mentioning that we need to text amend the definitions for development permit, and land development regulations in order to, in addition to addressing permit choice rule and vested rights. There was another part of this 128-page session law that set forth this provision. Zoning regulations cannot use definitions of building, dwelling unit, bedroom, and sleeping unit that are inconsistent with the state building code. Sounds innocuous enough on its paper, but I'll tell you that you don't often hit grand slam home runs in trial. I had a grand slam home run in the past 6 months in New Hanover County where BOA denied the application, and we got a judicial review of that denial, and everything I argued was the judge agreed with. One of the arguments that the judge agreed with, which reversed the BOA decision and ended up being victory, was a preemption argument. We argued that state law preempted what the Wilmington was trying to do under the zoning ordinance based on the definition of dwelling unit that the zoning ordinance had. That zoning ordinance, the preemption, the statute said a zoning code is preempted if it defines dwelling unit in a way that's inconsistent with the state building code. So this is actually an expansion of that statute. And in my instance, I had a regulatory action that was dependent on the zoning code's definition of dwelling unit, which was inconsistent with the state building code. So I argued that state law preempted that and that one of these actions had no force in effect. And the judge bought that argument 100%. So you may look at it and say, okay, definition is no big deal, but that was substantively applied to reverse a BOA decision and end up being a victory for my client. So I definitely think that we need to, I took a quick peek at those definitions and they don't match 100% with the state building code. So I do think we need to amend the code to conform those definitions to the state building code definitions. I don't think there's much discussion about that.
Okay.
Then finally, subdivision regulations. Every time the legislature meets, they tweak. There's a statute that requires performance guarantees when a subdivider comes in for final plat approval. He can get the final plat approval as long as he either completes the infrastructure or gives the town performance guarantees securing the completion of that if he falls and goes belly up. And every session they tweak the statute, and this particular tweak was pretty extensive. It listed the various ways, the various types of performance guarantees, that those guarantees are at the election of the developer, not the city or the town, and also clarified the scope and duration of those. We have a pretty good provision in the code regarding performance guarantees, but it doesn't match these changes. And performance guarantees can be a fairly ripe source of litigation. So it's my recommendation that we delete the current provision and just basically reword it in accordance with this particular set of revisions that are recently enacted.
Not the last time we have kind of had that issue since 2006.
It happens a lot.
Nice to be in agreement with the state.
So that completes the land development, zoning, and subdivision regulations that are currently effective, which the commission has reached a consensus in each instance needs text amendments. As I mentioned earlier, I do need to do the BOA memorandum, legislative update memorandum for BOA on the changes to quasi-judicial. Let me just mention, just for your all's edification or interest, in the past, before July, zoning interpretations and zoning decisions that an applicant disagreed with were always appealed to the Board of Adjustment, period. Well, there's been a big change. Now, if that zoning interpretation or the zoning decision falls into certain defined categories, then the applicant can take that appeal not to BOA, but directly to civil court. And that's profound because that's time and money. That's legal fees. That's significant legal fees. In addition to that, the General Assembly has enacted a provision that awards in certain instances, and I'd have to go back. It's not for you all because you all don't do this, but and I'll have it ready when I get to BOA on the end of the month. But it may interest you to know that certain things that used to go to BOA can now go to Civil Superior Court, and in those instances, the court can or may. The court, I think, has discretion, but is also maybe mandatory in one instance to award attorney's fees to the prevailing party. So you could have what used to be a BOA situation end up in Civil Superior Court, and if you lose, an award of attorney's fees against the town for that. So that's a very significant change. Those are the kind of things that I'll be addressing with BOA. I've got that memorandum. My suggestion is I will try my best to do all these text amendments in time for the February meeting, but I can't warrant that I'll get it all done by then. Okay. That's basically 3 weeks. And
More than likely, it'll be 4 weeks because I'm guessing we'll push that back.
To, well, yeah.
Same thing.
I don't have to the, a lot to the 11th. Do a lot of text amendments. Yeah, okay. I'll do my best, but it may have to table your review of those in February until March, but I certainly will try.
Okay.
Any questions about anything?
Nope. Any questions? Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Good job.
All right, agenda item number 5 under old business is what I request, and that's coming back to the...
Give the public right-of-ways.
Yes, this whole thing is attached.
Oh, public right-of-ways, okay. Text amendment.
Oh, we have for that?
Flip the page.
Yeah. Oh, regarding public right-of-ways, that's right. Okay, removal of... Okay, you're right.
Before we start, John, did you get a chance to look at this at all before?
Most of what I recommend it comes from John.
Okay, good. Okay.
I'll give you some background.
Okay.
All right, so this is the removal of obstructions and encroachments that we talked about last time.
Right.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, Commissioner Richardson brought this issue up. I guess this came up on his radar screen before the last month's meeting. He put some words on paper and passed them on to John. John's comments, I think, were made in red. I had the benefit of both commissioners and John's comments, and I basically used John's comments for most of the recommended text amendments. Of course, the topic is Commissioner Richardson felt that we needed some clarification on where the right-of-way ended with respect to the property line. And Commissioner Richardson, as well as John, were concerned about encroachments into the right-of-way. We're basically focused on the unpaved portion of the right-of-way abutting residential homes because the parking regulations allow those residents to park on the unpaved portion of that right-of-way. And apparently there's been roping off and barricading those sections of the right-of-way for whatever reason. So when we met last time, it was my opinion, we discussed that we didn't really need too many text amendments to make it work. And here's what I'm bringing to you now. With respect to the definition of the public right-of-way, I'm looking at page 102, and you can also see on the screen the first red line right here. I forget who, Commissioner Richardson or Mr. Batson recommended the insert there at the very end of the definition, private property does not extend to the street edge, the street being the improved portion of the public right-of-way, not the unpaid portion. I think that's helpful. I think that tells you that as a landowner, you don't own any part of that right-of-way, that your property stops at your property line, period. With respect to the encroachment issue, if you look at the bottom of this page, you can scroll down, Ms. Chase. Yeah. Parking, and we recommended a text amendment to 10.19.20 parking rules. We clarified with the very first insert there, the third line down, that only passenger vehicles We didn't make that distinction when we originally did the regulation, so vehicles by itself was fairly broad and ambiguous, but since passenger vehicles are the only vehicles that can park on the empty portion in front of a house, so go ahead and throw that in there. And then I think it was John that came up with the final couple sentences there. Property owners must keep the unpaved portion of the right-of-way abutting their front yard clear of any obstacles, impediments, plantings, or structures. Property owners are specifically prohibited from barricading or roping off any portion of the right-of-way or posting signage therein. The only items permitted in the unpaved portion of the right-of-way are mailboxes. I think that last one comes out of a provision in the code, I don't really recall. And then on the on the next page, in chapter 13.02.06, this would be on page 2, the top of page 2. Yeah, okay, that's that. Thank you. The original statute, or the original code provision, upon a report that there are obstructions or encroachments, and of course I'm referring back to the last text, recommended text amendment that we just discussed, obstructions or encroachments on any of the streets or sidewalks, well, we left, I think, plugging in public right-of-ways clearly references the authority to remove those, and therefore refers back to the one we just looked at under the parking rules about barricading and roping off, et cetera, et cetera. So I basically used the two gentlemen's suggestions to come up with this approach. They may have additional thoughts. They may disagree with this approach. This is what I'm recommending, but I'm certainly open to changes that we can discuss. I will mention that this is your BZC review. After this, it goes to council with your recommendation. We don't need consistency statements because none of these are zoning, proposed zoning text amendments. So consistency statements not required.
How about a public hearing by council?
Well, that's council's business. I don't know if they do.
But that's not required. You know.
Does council do a public hearing for any text amendment to the code, or just anybody recall?
Depends on what it has to do with.
Zoning is required.
Zoning is required.
Anything else that is a red, they might decide to have a public. It's at their discretion.
Okay.
Let me say one other thing before we move on. And you all pass muster on this. Commissioner Richardson subsequently conveyed his thoughts about what type of vehicle should be parking in that unpaved portion. I think you were focused on commercial trucks.
Yeah, we were trying to, yeah.
My thinking is, and again, it's open to revision, I think the parking regulations are clear that the only vehicles that can park in the unpaved portion of the right-of-way are passenger vehicles, which is why I made that insert. Belonging to the resident of the residential structure that abuts that right-of-way. If that's the only vehicle that can park there, any other vehicle that parks there is illegally parked. So I don't know that we need to amend the code to address those specific concerns, since I think the code, by limiting parking in those locations of passenger vehicles, addresses that. So let's discuss these two things.
The only thing I had been thinking about on this is, of course, this is more with sidewalks and all that, that the owners are responsible to maintain and keep the public right-of-way in a safe condition. Do we need, John, do you think, to put something in there that, well, this is not your property, as a condition of you building there, you still need to maintain that portion?
Well, Commissioner, again, if you...
Is it in there already? I apologize.
Can you scroll up or get to the big one? Yeah. Property owners must keep the unpaid portion of the right-of-way abutting their front yard clear of any obstacles,
right,
plantings or structures.
But I'm not going to mow it anymore.
No, you have to keep it clear.
But that, so yeah, I'm just using that. You think that, go ahead, that gives you enough to do, yeah, what you need to do? Okay.
Yeah, it's located elsewhere in the
world. Okay, that's I'm happy. Okay.
The only thing that doesn't apply to is the corner lots.
So that particular issue.
That, I'm fine with
getting
that.
Getting back to these text amendments, do these work for you?
Exactly what I wanted to see. I think the town will be ahead. I think there'll be more amendments to the parking ordinance in the next year. So if something's not working, I will let you guys know.
Okay.
But that right there is perfect.
Okay.
So I forget, I guess you all do a motion on whether to
recommend. Because it has to be passed
any
on.
Any other questions before you all
do? Are there any other questions?
Nope.
Any comments? Is there a motion to recommend to council these text amendments that have been presented?
I'll make a motion to present to council these text amendments as presented.
Okay. And seconded. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Opposed? Thank you. All right. Now, agenda item number five here has to do with something we've been talking about. Again, the court case that said we have to specify prohibited uses rather than simply a catch-all statement that if it's not allowable, it's prohibited. So I volunteered to go ahead and see if I could find a list that other cities have been using. I couldn't find a list. Quite frankly, I couldn't find a single list of prohibited uses that have been specified.
Telling you all that you're the most proactive.
We are. You know, I mean, the only one I could find is adult entertainment type of things. And so what I will do for our next meeting is I will just take one, because these would affect all of our zoning categories. And I think it's a hugely complicated issue, particularly when you look, let's say, at a residential zoning where we will allow certain kind of small uses. Does this mean that now we have to, in every single one of our residential zonings, prohibit everything else? So I'm not quite sure. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick the B1 district and come up with a list using either the SIC code definitions or the IRS definitions of businesses that what I would recommend we specify as prohibited uses in the B1. Have that discussion and see what comes of that discussion. The other thing, too, is when you start prohibiting things, let's say adult, and I did find this in several different city ordinances trying to address this issue, is let's say adult entertainment. You might have as an allowable use a small grocery store. But in that small grocery store, they may have a magazine rack that has adult magazines. So specifying just a business that would be prohibited, we need to also have language in there that specifies an activity within a acceptable use that would be prohibited also. And again, I saw different attempts by different cities to, you know, have language such as that. So what I will do is I will try to, at least for the B1, come up with a list using either SIC codes or the IRS definitions of a business, the sort of things that we may want to have specified as prohibited for our next meeting.
I think in all fairness, Chairman, we all said we were going to look at all of them and come bring our list up.
I know.
And I failed in that. But I think that would be good for all of us to
kind of think of
for any of the districts and bring our list next time.
Okay.
2 points. Keep in mind that, 3 points maybe. You're talking about uses that you're
right,
interested in prohibiting. So make sure that distinction is clear, the use of property. 2, don't drill down too deep because things will get complicated. For example, First Amendment came to mind with respect to the magazine rack, so mm-hmm. I wouldn't drill down too deep. And that's my point. Think about collateral issues like First Amendment. You know, if you're going to shut something down, are you regulating content? And if you're regulating content, you're going to have a First Amendment issue. So
I think if you keep it broad with the SIC code and approach it as a use scenario, that
what I saw in some of the ordinances, you know, because again, you might have a retail shop that would sell adult material, but they would sell non-adult material, and they would argue, no, we're just a retail store, and therefore you can't regulate me. As I saw, probably the most common is where people use a percentage. So they will say if the percentage of a content is adult, then it's classified as an adult business, let's say. You may want to think about how to address that particular issue.
Two comments. Another way to limit or eliminate uses that you don't want to outright prohibit is to set up geographical restrictions that can't be met. For example, you can't, let's say, you can only put an adult establishment in District X, provided that the adult establishment is no closer than, I don't know, 1,500 linear feet from a church or a school.
Right.
You got to analyze the situation, figure out where X is, so that those geographical restrictions can't be met. So you're not saying you can't, but nobody can.
Right.
The other thing, an interesting anecdote about what you just mentioned. I had a client one time that was an adult store, and he played by the rules. And this was in Wilmington. He played by the rules. In other words, he put his store in the district where it was allowed, which was definitely out of the way and on the fringe, and it affected his ability. It affected his commercial productivity. Meanwhile, he had four or five competitors that were clearly located in districts where on paper they weren't allowed, but they got around it by using these percentage yada yada yada. In other words, when they went to get their zoning compliance permit, they would set up these percentages and on paper they looked good. Well, I was hired to file complaints with zoning code enforcement that they were illegally located. He shut down three of his competitors because he was right. That was an interesting one.
So I would recommend we table this item until our next item, but we have it on the agenda because it is something I think that we need to address given the court hearing. So is there a motion to table that item number five, uses?
I'll make a motion.
Yeah. Okay. It's been motioned and seconded. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. New business, light pollution ordinance and dark sky regulations.
I get the PowerPoint.
Oh, you want to go down and do it down there?
Yeah. I stay up here. Do I need to go down there?
Technology.
I touched it, so it's probably going to be whack.
It'll work.
All right, so there we go. I've got a PowerPoint that I've got up there, and what tonight is about is kind of an introduction to it. I'm going to talk through several things. This was a horrifically long presentation that I cut a lot of material out of. And again, that's why I thought tonight was a bit of an introduction. We've kind of said dark sky regulations, and a lot of this material was put together by the International Dark Sky Association. But one of the important points to remember here is dark sky does not mean dark ground. We're not talking about turning all the lights off in the town or like we had in the meeting room here a little earlier. It's about quality lighting rather than just light everywhere. So hopefully the technology works. So what is outdoor lighting? What is this in reference to? Well, it's pretty much every outdoor light that there is, from street lights to roadways to parks to, we don't have stadiums here, but parking lots, walkways, landscaping, residential, you know. If it's a light and it's outdoors, it's pretty much encompassed in this at some point in time. And really the purpose for outdoor lighting, for the most part, is to provide safe, secure environment at night. I mean, that's what we do it for, so that we've got extended use of facilities, and walkways, and our boardwalk, and all of those kinds of things. So what is light pollution? And that's a map of the globe at night, but it's wasted light, wasted energy, glare, light trespass, and I highlighted the bit there where you know, like that goes where it's not supposed to go, like into your neighbor's window or creating dark spots and blind spots. So a couple of examples, we've got some things here. We'll talk about some outdoor lighting. You know, that's obviously for safety and security on a door with a deck. You know, outdoor lighting should enhance visibility, not impede it. Be part of the total nightscape, not allow light trespass onto other property, and really should fit a master plan. As I've been digging into this, it's amazing how many places already have light ordinances, and it's something that I really believe we need to follow on with. So, you know, outdoor lighting should light up where it's needed, you know, create safe places, extended use of spaces. A lot of this comes down to how the lighting is set up, and shielded lights or luminaries are a big deal. There's an example there from their webs or from their pages. You know, we don't need light that shines up. We don't need light that goes where it's not supposed to go. So the example there shows, you know, it's lit up the ground on the left picture. There's a lot of wasted light, a lot of glare, a lot of bright light going into neighbors and other properties where it's not needed. And the picture on the left shows lighting that's good. So unshielded lights, you know, sky glow, glare. The picture on the left there is actually Los Angeles. And if you're ever in Los Angeles and you look up, you can barely see the moon, let alone any stars, just because of the constant haze. The picture on the right is rather interesting, too, because it talks about how poorly set up light actually creates danger. You'd think that was a well-lit parking lot, but you can't see the person that's standing to the right of that van that's parked there in the parking lot. And I actually did blow that picture up and zoom in and look at it, and there really is a person standing to the right of that vehicle that you'd have no idea was actually there. Issues that we have, and this is one of the things that brought this to my attention to bring it up here, is, you know, light trespass into buildings. Where you don't need it. And again, this is a picture of a street light. This could easily be a neighbor's light into a neighbor's home. So apart from the energy costs and the other things, and there's plenty of examples on that I'm going to go over very quickly here because this is an introduction, but no point wasting energy, no point doing stuff. We're going to light well and look at it environmentally responsibly. Unshielded lights actually have more information on them being unsafe than safe. So here we have a student campus. Obviously that light was put there to highlight the student that's in the middle of that picture so that you could see him and he could see around him. But can anybody find him in that picture? He's actually he's actually standing right directly under the light. So he took two steps to the left as if he was facing you. The person is still standing in that picture. Now, if that was somebody wanting to do something untoward, hiding in the shadows, waiting for somebody to cross, that big bright light didn't actually help. So, there are negative impacts of improper lighting, big negative impact on wildlife. I know we've got a lot of folks in our community care about turtles and fish and sea life and all kinds of other stuff. So improper lighting has a big impact on wildlife. It has a big negative impact on human health with light trespass into bedrooms, disrupting sleep patterns. Glare and the color of light can be blinding and reduce night vision and actually even hurt vision with headaches and other things with bright blue lights or some of the newer LEDs. So there are several negative impacts from there. And kind of just a good health feeling, there's a negative impact on astronomy as well and things like that that we could enjoy more of if we had darker skies. So solutions are pretty simple. It's really about controlling the light to where it goes where you want it. Left and right picture there is the same setup. One light's got shielding on it and the other one doesn't. You can obviously see they both provide light on the ground where it's needed without providing the glare and the ugly part. There are lots of examples here that I'm going to go through pretty quickly, but that's obviously horrific glare in that picture. So when it comes to outdoor lamps, and this doesn't make any difference from street lamps to the lamps on the side of your house by your doorway or on the boardwalk or anything else, good lighting angles the light down without giving glare or horizontal light trespass. Lots of examples on that. So some examples in cities, we've got good lighting to the right of that picture, bad lighting to the left, good lighting in the gas station below, bad lighting above it, you know, just to give examples of what things can look like. At an ATM, dark spots again, some things. So those are some of the examples. This is an interesting one, and this was a test area where they took a street, which you can see in the picture on the right, it actually goes all the way through, and there's a dark spot when you're looking at it from above in the middle of that where the blue arrow is, and that's where the controlled lighting is. The actual street level lighting was still safe and secure and providing what it needed. So I drove around on Sunday night and thought I'd just take a few pictures around town. And I didn't think this was a bad example. Those lights may be reflecting off the building, but they are actually canned lights pointing down and wasn't too bad. One that didn't do so well was this big bright light that created some very dark shadows to the left and had some light trespass in the house next door. Wouldn't want to be in that bedroom if that's a bedroom at night. Good example, we're sitting right here now in the town hall. That was awesome to drive by and see how well lit everything was with no glare anywhere around it. It's extremely well lit. A bad example was just a bit around the corner where you can barely tell which building that is because there's so much light coming off of the sides of it. And that's unfortunately our fire station. The light glare across the street from that was quite noticeable. This house, I actually picked up the light, the big white wall that you see on the house on the right, all of that light's coming off of the house on the left. There's no outside light on that house. So every one of their windows has got light shining into it. Same kind of thing on this. The house on the right didn't have any exterior lights on. The house on the left had a lot of light trespass into that property. Another good example is our beachfront. We've got some warm color lighting, down shielded, looks very, very good. But across the street from it on the boardwalk, very, very bright lights that shine back across the street. This picture is rather interesting because I decided I would try and do a copy of the picture where you can't see people. And I know it's hard to see on the TV and in a presentation, and you can't even see it on there, but there are two people standing this side of a swing chair that could easily grab somebody, mug somebody, do something else, and you can't see them. Because the light next to it is so bright and got so much glare, it detracts from your night vision that you can't see who's next to it. So I'm sure everybody had great intentions when setting this up, but it actually made for a bad situation. So in trying to keep this short and taking the dark sky presentation from well over 70 slides down to something that was manageable, put some examples to it. Today's introduction was just about what is outdoor lighting and why is this important. And we really want to look at the quality of light around the town from all of the outdoor lights. I want to look at light trespass, light temperature, and things like that. It's not about making the town dark. It's about putting light where it's appropriate. There are some very good codes that I don't want to take up too much time on tonight's agenda and get into, but there are some exceptionally good codes from around the country that are already written on how to actually do that without being overly complicated, that address both wildlife, oceanfront, cityfront, and other activities. And I would like to continue exploring this with the Planning and Zoning Commission and Joseph, if you've got any comment from town as to where this may go.
Believe it or not, all those lights on the boardwalk are turtle friendly.
If they are, great.
So
I at this point it's purely an introduction and discussion, but it's rather interesting how a very bright light creates dark shadows, and dark shadows have the opposite effect of what people are trying to do by lighting an area.
David, I think the presentation put together was you know, it hits a lot of the points you're talking about. The technology is a little bit more complex when you start selecting certain fixtures and or shielding or reflecting dimming capabilities and things like that. So, yeah, you can do all those things with the technology available. It's just how do you tell a residential customer? How would you address that issue?
Some of the code that I read and things like that had a kind of an immediate grandfather clause to them, so that you don't have to tell everybody they've got to change everything right away. But when something needed repair or when it needed a bulb replaced, you would try and comply. There was also some extended grace periods. There were also some things where, you know, having motion sensing floodlights can be a good thing, and they recommended the floodlights be set up with timers less than 5 minutes and to not shine directly in windows if possible and things like that. So there's a tremendous amount can be put into this. I've found code examples that seemed almost as big as our entire town code on lighting, and I found some very good examples that are just 2 pages of detail. So that's part of the discussion, is how does it get applied and how does it get worked in, and
absolutely,
that's very important.
As an example, you look at the manufacturer's technology in the products that are available, like these troffers. These are the 2x4 lights you see up there. To me, it's a little blinding. You go to a different manufacturer, you wouldn't even notice the lights were there. That's the difference, and you really have to understand the products and the technology, and that's some of the things that when you start to do this thing, you're getting a lighting architect involved. You have to get more specifics about certain things and requirements around that.
I didn't want to get too deep into it on a first pass, but I did think there was merit in setting up some simple standards and starting in the process.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, I work in this, but
you know, fortunately
for us. Yeah, yeah, for the rest of us.
So I go deep pretty easy into it, but there are things, and there are so much you can do. So you're dead on with your presentation. It's just that we got to be very clear what we're asking, you know, the town or, you know, businesses or even residents to do.
One of the examples, and I took a lot of photographs, one of the examples is the new Cove subdivision. If you happen to drive past that at night, they have some excellent lights on their street. They light the street very well with no glare, no trespass onto the buildings that they've got there. So it's a great example. Some of the communities I drive around see what's good street lighting. You know, now some of the neighbors don't have great lights, but, you know, good street lighting. There's a lot in Kerry Beach that's actually very good. But again, it's let's start with a simple code. Let's start putting some things together and start getting some good ideas.
I agree 100%. In fact, if you remember when we were talking about the golf cart rental, that I asked to have a lighting component there because they were going to have a 24-hour light, and you know, so trying to have it shielded so it doesn't trespass into the surrounding residential and commercial type of areas. So, and you know, I have to admit it's very, very disturbing. We've got, you know, we're on a pond type of area, and there's probably about 10 houses behind us, and there's one house that turns on its spotlights and then leaves for 2 months, and my daughter can't sleep in a room. She cannot sleep in a room because of the trespass. The shines right into the bedroom. So I'm a big fan of a simple shielded type of set of rules. I'm not a big fan of grandfathering. I think that you can amortize things over a reasonable amount of time, ask people to put motion detectors on searchlights or, you know, that sort of thing. So the way we've done this sort of thing in the past with the commission, because we're all volunteers here, we don't have staff that we could direct to come up with the code, is to just bring in what you would recommend as a template to start working with, and then we can work from that particular
point. I found two very good pages of code from my searches, and actually they're the two that were on the side there. I don't know if you want to pull them up if we want to go that deep tonight, but one is specifically for beachfront lighting and outward lighting is just one page, and the other is just for town lighting and around homes and light trespass and what is an acceptable level and not an acceptable level. They're both from the city of Dania Beach in Florida. I just picked those because they were nice, clean code examples. Ocean Isle, Surf City, plenty of other more local places have similar codes, but they're not quite as clean and well written as I thought these were.
The thing that you have to be concerned about is when it's the town's lights or the business's lights or things you have control over. That's one thing, but if you start looking at utility, they're not owned by the town or, you know, the local utility, it's a bigger and a different issue to deal with.
Yeah.
And either the town pays for it.
Well, we can't regulate a utility.
Well, the town can pay for it.
Yeah, we can pay for it, but we can't regulate it.
And you could put whatever you want to over there, but you're going to be at your cost.
Yeah, right. Again, there's a ton of discussion to be had around this. I wanted to put it on the table as an introduction and start that discussion, because I think long term, I think it will have an impact on the small village feel that we want for this town too. It could be a big bright ball of light, or we can kind of have comfortable light that everybody's happy with.
Because we don't have anything. We don't have any lighting lights at all right now.
Most places don't, and it makes a big difference. You know, when you do exactly what you're trying to do, you can present it to us, and it does change that feeling. You can do so many things with the new LED technologies.
Well, I've gone through this and looked at my own house and thought, I need to do some things.
Well, do we want to do just come into the ordinance, or do we want to look at an inventory of what the town has?
I think the first part is to look at some codes, which is what I've already started doing, and try and develop what a starting point would look like for the codes, and then we'd have to look at what it would take to comply with that, or what amortization or what rules would have to fit around it. That's my initial thought.
I would say we need to look at the codes, but in couch it in the terms of what we're able to do, as in with LED light from Duke that's filling our streets, and you know, not get, you know, I have this feeling like this code could just go, you know. We need to put some boundaries on what we're going to try to do here, I think.
Well, and that's why I like the two examples from Dania Beach.
Because they're probably
those for everybody so they can.
The emphasis is going to be on shielding. Clearly it's shielding type of issue.
Every street light in down Settlers Lane would need shielding. If you put
right, but we can't control that. But we could control certain things.
So now you've got All Settlers Lane. You're making everybody else do something, but All Settlers Lane is they're not doing anything, and that's where residents would say, wait a minute. You're making me change something, but what about that light right in front of my house?
You can do whatever you would like to do. But there's a cost associated.
I'm sure the council is not going to put a budget to change every street light in Curry Beach.
Some cities have.
I'll leave that up to them.
I mean, because it's generally just a shielding issue. It's a shielding issue, which isn't that expensive.
The one in front of my house, it means it has to be shielded in the front.
You can't take certain technologies and shield.
They just change all LEDs.
Do what you want to do. It's built into the reflection.
No, I understand. I'm just saying that you don't want to start making all these businesses do something, make residents do something, and then they drive down Settlers Lane and say, why isn't the town doing it? That's what I'm saying. I want to make sure that if we do something, it's balanced.
Okay.
That's my opinion.
Yeah, color is another and option.
And it's not only Settlers, it's every street we have a street light from Duke.
Well, again, I would recommend that we keep this on the agenda and just bring forth a proposed,
okay,
you know, a simple proposed ordinance, and then we can talk about it.
Do you have something on the table? Are there grants out there to do this kind of work?
I'm not aware of that yet. I've not done any research on that. I would imagine there are. There's a ton of information. I can go back to the International Dark Sky Association. They've got lots of resources to help with this kind of stuff. I didn't go to them specifically yet to get any of that, other than getting their website information and stuff, because I wanted to see what the field was before we went too deep into it. But again, I would suggest if we send out the Dania Beach codes that I found, it's just two pages, it's very simple. Mm-hmm. If you guys would look at that and give us, and we could start with that as a discussion point. I think that'd be a great way to continue this next month.
It needs to stay on old business for a while till we get it done.
Yeah. Is that okay with everybody?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
All right, excellent. All right, last item is, again, changing the date for our February meeting. I think.
Well, I had a member item.
Oh, you had a member item? Okay.
Yeah. I was talking to council before concerning our parking meetings and trying to determine, do we have to do anything with the ordinance if the town decides to go to paid parking? And
what did you put that to council?
I was asked a couple of questions about, as I understand it, paid parking is being considered by, I assume, a committee that may make a recommendation.
Right.
I suggested that any such recommendation include the following, that PCC look at the current parking regs in the context of that recommendation to see if any text amendments would be needed.
Yeah.
There was an issue of whether a request for proposal should go out before. Strike that. Point two, how would you implement such a change? And I knee-jerk thought by ordinance. And number three, if there was such an ordinance, do RFPs, requests for proposals, go out before or after the ordinance, which I felt was a town attorney issue that I didn't want
right,
to
get
involved. So if recommendations go to council, I would have the subjectively speaking, I would have the recommendation include PCC review and town council opinion on the timing of the RFP.
So I just didn't want us to do something.
What is the timeline, would you say, for a park?
We have the next meeting tomorrow night, 6 to 8.
And that's the parking committee, right? The ad hoc parking committee?
Well, it's just Craig and I, really.
Okay.
And then at that point, we'll get the parking committee back together and look at everything that's been brought before us, and we may request or want to do an RFP at that point, just to get an idea of what money could be out there, because it will be contracted out to see what we call.
Okay.
Out of that, if we can get this done by Memorial Day, that'd be great, if we decide to go that route. But if we can't hammer out the right way to do this, this could go to the next season.
Okay. Just very quickly as an update too, what's the latest on land use planning, just in terms of milestones and updates and stuff?
So that's probably going to be March or April.
Okay.
So, I mean, the groups will stay the same. I've already been trying to read some of it. But then we will open it up for applications to citizens probably in March. Absorb all the stuff that our General Assembly is doing here first, with this training and whatever changes we need to make with those ordinances, and then we'll jump into the plan. We have until next June, I believe it is, to get in place.
I don't recall exactly.
Is there going to be a requirement for counsel, legal counsel, as we develop the new land use plan, or is that something we can do without legal counsel? So that's what I'm getting at, because it's not really a P&Z. It's a, you know, where are you going to be the legal counsel for the land use plan development?
I'm a member of the committee, and there are some changes with respect to future land use plans that are in part two of this big session law that we are reviewing, and but I haven't gotten there yet. I tend to think BZC might have to review a future land use plan before. I don't recall exactly before.
Yeah, we'll do the work, present it to y'all.
But we'll find out any statutory procedure, and we'll take it as it comes. But I'm on the committee, so we'll have a liaison with you all. Let y'all know what's going on.
Okay. And then the last member item is a reminder regarding the training session, which is on the, what's the 23rd?
Next Thursday.
Next Thursday. I may not be able to do it. I'm sorry, but that's a big teaching day for me. And given that's our second week of classes, I probably can't cancel classes for that.
Think how happy the students would be.
Somebody might want to bring it forth as a member item. Did you want to entertain the idea of 6:30 or soon thereafter?
Yes.
Before your regular meeting?
Yeah, that's what we're getting.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. All right. So then let's talk about our next meeting date. I think there was a proposal for the Historic Preservation Commission to move it to
February 11th.
Yes.
Is right. there a similar motion for this?
So moved.
Okay.
Second.
And then the final is to change the language, and what, Counselor, what's the language you would recommend?
I would suggest entertaining a motion to amend the regular meeting schedule for PZC meetings to begin at 6:30 or as soon thereafter as the Historic Preservation Committee meeting is adjourned.
Okay. Is there a motion to that language?
So moved.
I need a vote on the first motion.
Oh.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. So the first motion is to change the February meeting to February 11th. It's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. We need a motion for the language.
So moved.
So moved. Is there a second for starting at 6:30 with the appropriate language? Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Anything else from the members? Is there a motion to adjourn?
Motion.
Okay, we got a motion and seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Very good. Thank you.
Questions at the door.